Fred Film Radio, International Documentary Film Festival, Amsterdam, Netherlands.
Fred from Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 2017 International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam. I'm very pleased to be joined by director Phil Cox. Thank you very much for joining us, first of all.
Hey, great to be here, yeah, thanks.
So you're presenting a documentary called Betty, They Say I'm Different.
Yeah.
Would you like to introduce the film to our listeners and tell us as much as you'd like about it?
Yeah, so it's a film, Betty, They Say I'm Different, about a woman called Betty Davis, who's an extraordinary individual, really. She was a black pioneering funk singer, writer from the 70s, and also one-time wife of Miles Davis. And she's really a woman who I knew very little about, and people say Betty Davis, they often think of the actress, the white actress, Bette Davis. But actually, I think Betty Davis has more claim to a cultural legacy in the United States than Bette Davis, really. When I heard about her and the fact that also she disappeared for around 35 years after making three sort of blistering funk albums and really causing great controversy in 70s America, taking on the establishment. And when I heard she disappeared, we sort of set out to find her. My producer, Jamin Smith, and Giovanna Stepone. And it took a couple of years to really get to find Betty and make contact, because she'd become a recluse. So really the story starts there. There's this black pioneering funk woman who, you know, turned Miles Davis upside down, took on the establishment, and then for some reason just disappeared off the face of the earth, really. And that's where this film really begins.
Why would you say she's a pioneering artist?
Betty, I mean, first of all, you have to understand the time and the context she was in. So in 70s America, you had civil rights happening, you had Nixon, and you had a period where, especially being black, it was about integration, fitting in, or being part of the civil rights movement. So Betty Davis was she came from humble beginnings, grew up in a steel town. But she started performing, electrifying, sexual, bold, provocative music that was very female-led empowerment at a time when it was completely unheard of. And if you were black, you should be singing about struggle, or you should be fitting in to the corporate establishment. So she was one of a kind before anyone else was doing it. So she was really paving a way for sort of liberated female artists 10, 15 years before anyone else was doing it. You have people like Tina Turner come along, but you know, Tina had someone like Ike, and they were fitting into more of a formula. But Betty Davis was a total wild card. You know, she wrote her own music, she performed it. She did everything herself, and even today that's still very hard for a performer, let alone a black woman.
She was ahead of her time.
Yeah, Betty was ahead of her time massively, and she suffered because of that. And also she was completely uncompromising. She married Miles Davis, one of the greatest musicians, jazz musicians ever, and was really the catalyst to turn him from classic straight jazz to jazz fusion, jazz rock. I introduced him to Jimi Hendrix, turned him upside down, the way he dressed, the way he, you know, thought about his own music. Miles was in a period where he was becoming very stale. And it was also a period where the black community were really turning away from jazz. You know, there were Stax, Psychedelic, Motown. And Miles was becoming irrelevant in a way. And he knew that. And meeting Betty Davis, who he credits for this, provoked Bitches Brew, you know, Philly Kilimanjaro, and a whole new wave. And Betty hung around for a year, and then she left Miles. So it's sort of, in a way, Miles took more from Betty than Betty took from Miles. And also, you know, there was undertones of a violent relationship there. So Betty Davis, you know, the more I learned about her, this extraordinary woman, And her impact, and also how it's sort of not been recognised. It became, you know, there was a strong story there and a chance to make a film. Little did I know how long that would take, and also on finding Betty, that her character would still be just as cantankerous and idiosyncratic as she was then, and uncompromising. So it took a long time to persuade her to make a film.
Right, because the documentary is based on a series of conversations you had with her. Mm. How did you meet her anyways? Was it difficult to find her?
Yeah, it was difficult to find her. There was one or two people who knew where she was and had made contact with her. They're sort of like the gatekeepers, you know, she trusted them. So we went through them, and then really we had talks on the phone for a couple of years, especially my co-producer Damon Smith. And after 2 years she agreed to meet. And we went to Pittsburgh, where she is, and she was living as a recluse, very simple, poor, but living a sort of very private life. And then it took another year and a half before she really started to trust us to open up and tell her story. And even then, Betty doesn't do anything in a straightforward manner. It was a matter of sitting down and filming with her. You know, it was sort of abstract conversations and fragments of memories, and I realized also that there was a person completely different from this stage performer, and that's what I realized I had to bring into the film. And Betty Davis represented so many things for a lot of people around the world, as I discovered, from Holland, Australia, Japan, America, which was a cult following. And these people at a time in the 70s and 80s found Betty and sort of found a person who was totally liberated in their sexual empowerment and who they were and what they wanted to be. And they really found that inspiring in Betty. And Betty represented that political, personal self-emancipation, which, you know, doesn't really come about until late 80s, 90s, that we can be who we want to be sexually, colour, race, or anything. It just doesn't matter. So Betty had this huge cult following, and I started to find that, you know, people were starting to follow the film, and there was this build-up of support around it. But also in America, she had been forgotten and erased from not just funk history, but musical history, really. And that was a real shame, and something I wanted the film to address, that, you know, people from... you know, Betty comes from this legacy of blues women, you know, Etta James, Bessie Smith... going up to today, these people like Erykah Badu, Janelle Monáe, you know, even Beyoncé, you know, there's a line where they stand, these people stand on the shoulders of Betty. And she just came at a time that was just the worst time for her, really. There's this 5 to 10 year period where she would be on her own, couldn't break through into the industry, had a very tough marriage to Miles, and then her personal circumstance really broke her down and she disappeared.
With this documentary premiering here at IDFA, and also some of her records being re-released and reissued, even stuff that wasn't released at the time, I think her fourth album was recorded but never released until decades later. Do you think that she's happy that that's happening, or does she care?
Yeah, Betty... Betty's very much like take it or leave it in a way. I mean, she is happy that her music's still alive. She says, you know, I'm happy my music's still alive. When I found her, you know, she hadn't listened to some of her music for 25 years. She'd left music and gone to quite a spiritual place, very meditative. But, you know, her album still stands straight up there with Sly and the Family Stone, Funkadelic. You know, she's part of a period that today you listen to her stuff, and it's because of Betty's authenticity. Betty is not a beautiful singer. It's not like the Supremes. You know, she's not one of the divas of a beautiful voice. Betty is just raw and real. And I think it's why I also came to the project. When you find an artist who's so raw and authentic, whether they're a painter, a singer, or whatever, it's unique. Today, everything is packaged, everything is produced, everything sort of sounds the same, especially in the music industry. And when you find those artists who are just authentic, it's so compelling. It's like you really feel an authenticity in a person, and that's what I think we miss today.
So getting back to the actual filmmaking process, while you were having these conversations with her, did you start getting an idea of the visual style of the film, or did you have that an idea before you even started?
No, so approaching the film, I really had no concept of how to make the film. Obviously, especially this is an independent film, wasn't commissioned. We came in self-financed and as an indie team. So it was just, I had a completely open book, you know, blank page, and after about 2 years, I started to think, shit, how am I going to do this? Because Betty doesn't really want to be filmed. She won't really go anywhere.
It's not her voice either in the documentary.
Yeah, it's not her voice in the end. And a lot of people, there's no footage of her. A lot of people don't... There's a 30-year missing gap period that she doesn't want to talk about much. So for a filmmaker, it starts to become your, like, a bit of a nightmare. But then, as always, I think with any artistic thing, the more obstacles you have, you're forced to become creative. And you hate it at the time, but actually it can be a blessing. So I started to realize that, you know, Betty's spiritual side and the symbols in her life was the way to tell this film. So she has these specific symbols, the crow, the mountain, which chart her life. You know, the little bird, orange and bright, sat outside her window that became the crow, and this crow that accompanied her in a spiritual sense throughout her life, she talks about. So I realized I could tell the journey of this funk queen, the first funk queen, through the crow. And also the mountain, when, you know, when she went to Japan and she went up Mount Fuji, she had this sort of spiritual awakening and changed her life. And so these two symbols became my bedrock in the film. And then I mixed that with animation, really trying to bring her songs to life for an audience that don't know them. And then some standard interviews. And then I, you know, as a filmmaker, I had that capacity. And then the voice I took from her interviews in the 70s, her conversations with me, her song lyrics, and then I sat down with Betty and we did it. And I think that's, you know, it's documentary can be so creative today. And I mean, being British, we live in a very formulaic, television-led style, which is not really very interesting. But actually, documentary, you know, it's so innovative today. We can really mix up and mash up, you know, puppets, painting, animation, still photography. Everything can be smashed in there. And that gave me the chance to tell Betty's story.
Well, there's lots that we could talk about. I'm very curious. Well, of course, there's lots of great contributions from friends, family, and former bandmates of Betty. And then great clips and archive footage. Which is very hard to find, because I was looking it up on YouTube, and there isn't many videos of her live performances. I don't think there's any.
No, so that's with Betty Davis. There was one big thing. There's no live performance. So people had looked for years, nothing. But there was a rumor that in 1976 there was this big concert called La Castillette, which was called the Woodstock of Europe, organized by Michael Lang, who did the Woodstock in 69. And it was just, it turned, this festival in France in 76 turned into like a mafia, Corsican mafia run, like chaos. I mean, you had people playing there, Jimmy Cliff, Joe Cocker, I mean, you had great artists, and Betty stood in for Miles. Miles Davis couldn't make the concert, Betty went and played. And they recorded the whole concert in 16mm multiple camera footage, and this footage had disappeared for, you know, 40 years. So Giovanna, my producer, set off to hunt for it. And a long story short, we found a reel in a recently deceased guy's cupboard in some bizarre corner of the US. And there was a beautiful reel of Betty Davis playing in this concert on film. And, I mean, it was staggering to find it. And that's the only performance. And Betty's performance was mind-blowing. You know, it was great. So we used that within the film, because it was about her being live and what she did that so repelled people and attracted them. You know, Betty was banned by the NAACP, you know, within the black community, that she was too outrageous, she wasn't conforming. So to find this footage was just really important.
It was really great talking with you, and I wish you all the best. But where is this? Is there any plans for this documentary? Is it going on?
Yeah, so this is our world premiere at Amsterdam now, and then we're about to roll out in other festivals in the US specifically, and then coming to Italy, like Torino, and into the UK as well. We'll be announcing it on the website, which you check it out.
And the website is called?
It's called Nasty Girl Movie.
Okay.
Yep.
.com.
Yeah, nastygirlmovie.com, and the Facebook site to follow all the news.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.